This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The disease is in Ghana and an outbreak response is being planned, led by the government.
That's Oliver Christian Rosenbauer with the WHO's Global Polio Eradication Program. Details coming up also. Zimbabwe's right activists say the government is increasingly cracking down on its critics. And in the Gambia, people are mourning the death of the country's first democratically elected president. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, despite international condemnation of alleged abuses against opposition supporters and members of civil society groups, rights experts say the situation in Zimbabwe is worsening. Adi Gando gives us more on the story from Harare.
Last week, Zimbabwean satirist Samantha Kurea, known as Gonyeti, was abducted and tortured by suspected state security agents. The actress and comedian is part of Bustop TV, which creates skits on topical issues in Zimbabwean society. Bustop TV's social media pages have published a report of her ordeal, during which she suffered torture, humiliation, and beatings. Human rights activists say the incident is part of a recent pattern. Several opposition and civil society members have suffered abductions, beatings, arrests, and tortures at the hands of government security forces or those suspected of being government agents. Last week, the Agricultural Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, ATUS, staged a demonstration at the Ministry of Finance. Protesters were arrested and assaulted, along with their lawyer, Doug Coulthard. A journalist also was arrested by police while filming the teachers' demonstration over worsening pay and work conditions. Coulthard speaks about the arrest and incarceration alongside the teachers.
I asked the police what really is going on. Why are you arresting these teachers? And that's when the police surrounded me and started to arrest me. I asked what's the reason for my arrest. They didn't give me an answer. I was surrounded by about 10 police officers who then pushed me to the ground and started beating me with baton sticks and kicking me. I sustained an injury to the head, to my arms, to the legs. I was then subsequently bundled into the back of a police van and we were taken to Harare Central Police Station.
The union petitioners had attempted to approach the office of the finance minister when police swooped on them. Coulthard says police did not tell them why they were arrested in violation of their constitutional rights.
We were initially told that we would be charged with public violence, but because there hadn't been any violence, I think they realized that it would never stick. So that was, we were then told it would be a disorderly conduct, but even that was abandoned and they ended up going with criminal nuisance, which we were charged with on the Friday night and then taken to court on the Saturday.
Obed Masaraore, the president of the Teachers Union, says the demonstrators were peaceful petitioners who were improperly arrested.
We will not be cowed by the cowardly behavior of the state. We remain resolute. They cannot suppress the working class forever. Going forward, we are busy organizing for future protests, which obviously will begin with what we are dubbing the salary consolation church services, which will be holding countrywide.
NewsBubble.com journalist Leo Munende, who was arrested at the protest, says his editor struggled to get him released.
All along, Richard Chiza, my deputy editor, was trying Information Minister Monica Mchonga's mobile alongside her permanent secretary, Nick Mangwana, but they were not picking up. So he eventually called the national spokesperson for the Zimbabwe Republic Police, Paul Nyati, who said that you tried to get me out since I am a journalist and there's no need for me to be inside.
Munende was eventually released after a human rights lawyer and the journalist union leadership negotiated with police. The government denies accusations that it is behind the abductions and human rights violations. State media says the opposition is fabricating stories to tarnish the government's image. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
In the Gambia, today, people are mourning the death of the country's first democratically elected president, Dauda Kairaba Jawara. Jawara died yesterday in the capital, Banjul, at the age of 95. He was known as the father of the nation after he led the talks that led to Gambia's independence from Britain in 1965. He served as prime minister until he was elected president in 1970. The Glasgow-trained veterinarian served as president until 1994, when soldiers led by Yahya Jammeh ousted him with a coup after his government was accused of corruption and nepotism. He went into exile in Britain until Jammeh allowed him to return in 2002. Jammeh's government was accused of brutal human rights abuses and corruption. He lost an election in 2017 and has gone into exile himself in Equatorial Guinea. The World Health Organization has confirmed an outbreak of poliomyelitis in Ghana after a two-year-old girl tested positive for the disease. It's the first polio case in the country in more than a decade. The World Health Organization spokesperson for the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, Oliver Christian Rosenbauer, spoke with journalist Mavis Ocheri about the outbreak and efforts to contain it.
Yes, we can confirm that. The child came down with the symptoms of polio. So the disease is in Ghana, and an outbreak response is being planned, led by the government to try to immunize as many children as possible and stop this outbreak again.
What might be the cause for the outbreak in Ghana, since for a decade there wasn't a single case recorded in Ghana?
So this really underscores the dangers and the risks associated with polio. Ghana had been polio-free, but it's a highly infectious disease, and it travels easily with population movements. And this particular strain of poliovirus, which is a very rare strain, is actually circulating in Nigeria, and it's been detected across West and Central Africa. We've seen the same virus in Cameroon, in Benin, in Niger, and now also in Ghana. And so with the large-scale population movements across West and Central Africa, the danger is that that diseases such as polio can rapidly spread, and that is how Ghana became reinfected.
What are you currently doing to help contain the outbreak in Ghana?
Sure. So our role, together with our partners, for example, at CDC, UNICEF, and Rotary, we support the government, the Ministry of Health, and the local public health authorities in implementing the outbreak response strategies. And there's numerous aspects to that. First and foremost, to conduct an immunization campaign to vaccinate children to boost immunity so that the poliovirus that's circulating doesn't find any unvaccinated or susceptible children and really has nowhere to hide anymore. And also strengthening disease surveillance to make sure that any more cases are rapidly detected and can be responded to.
But is there a risk of spread to other parts of the country?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is the same virus that spread from Nigeria all the way to Ghana, via Benin. We've also seen it in other countries like Cameroon and Niger. So this is the risk that with population movements, the virus would be taken to other areas. Now, Ghana, the government has immediately responded and is doing all the right things in confirmation to this outbreak. And Ghana has relatively strong routine immunization services and relatively strong disease surveillance, which accounts for the fact that they were able to detect this virus very quickly. All that is kind of running in this favor, so we're confident that Ghana can rapidly stop this outbreak again, but the outbreak response needs to be fully implemented.
We know that this year the president has declared a year of return for people from the diaspora to come to Ghana. Should people take precautionary measures entering?
So what WHO in general recommends, that if you're going to be traveling to any polio-infected country, that you make sure that you are fully vaccinated according to your national vaccination schedule. If that includes potentially receiving a booster dose, then that would be our recommendation at that point.
That was Oliver Christian Rosenbauer with the WHO in Geneva. He was speaking with Mavis Ocheri. Fifteen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United Nations Refugee Agency today urged the governments of Tanzania and Burundi not to forcibly repatriate Burundian refugees in Tanzania. The UNHCR says conditions in Burundi are not currently conducive to promote returns, although security has improved since violence erupted after the country's 2015 presidential election. The deal to begin repatriating about 180,000 Burundi refugees from Tanzania beginning in October has sparked anxiety among the displaced. The two governments announced the agreement on Sunday. Nearly 350,000 Burundians fled their homes when violence broke out in 2015 because of controversial elections that gave President Pierre Nkurunziza a third term. Burundians also sought refuge in other countries, primarily Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda. Botswana says the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora sites has passed its sell-by date. This after Habrone and other southern countries called for an end to the ban. The CITES meeting, which ends in Geneva today, rebuffed Botswana, Namibia, and Zimbabwe's efforts to sell their ivory stockpiles. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube reports.
Botswana's Minister of Environment, Wildlife and Tourism, Kitso Mkaila, has questioned CITES' role after the Geneva meeting shot down proposals for a one-off sale of ivory stockpiles. Mukaila says an urgent meeting should be called to discuss the way forward.
Is CITES really worth it? I think CITES has long passed its sell-by date. We need something else, something that speaks to the issues of today, which is reality.
Botswana citizen Hagimutu Satua, who attended the Geneva conference, represents community trusts formed in areas with large wildlife populations. He urges his country and other affected Southern African countries to quit CITES.
My proposal was suggesting to the SADC and the other governments who are in agreeable terms is to move away from CITES. Otherwise, there is no point.
CITES upheld the ban on ivory trade, but Southern African countries argue they need to sell millions of worth of stockpile to fund expensive conservation programs. Locals, particularly affected by growing elephant populations, have added their voice, urging the Botswana government to pull out of CITES. Lisekho Rehoeng, a local farmer, says communities must benefit from natural resources and does not understand what CITES wants to achieve.
We are the ones who face challenges with these animals. I don't understand what logic CITES has applied. It's devoid of any science.
Botswana is not the only country which is mulling over a withdrawal from CITES. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa told state media in Harare that his country will consider withdrawing from CITES to better guard its wildlife. While Southern African nations are unhappy with the Geneva outcome, other African countries, including Kenya, were opposed to the lifting of the ban. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
18 of veterinarians in Kenya's All Pijeta Conservancy is trying to save the northern white rhino from extinction by using in vitro fertilization, or IVF. The last two northern white rhinos on Earth are living at the conservancy, but since they are both females, they cannot procreate. Vets have succeeded in extracting ova from both females and hope to fertilize them using northern white rhino sperm to produce viable embryos. Rude Elementrop reports from All Pijeta Conservancy in Kenya.
We're in the All Pijeta Conservancy in Kenya. Here, in a secure enclosure, two female northern white rhinos are grazing peacefully. But their fate seems to be sealed. They can't procreate anymore, since the last male northern white rhino, called Sudan, died last year. His tomb is not far away from here, in a windy field. It represents the obituary of a race that at one time, at the turn of the 20th century, numbered 3,000 animals. Now, with only two females left, the Olpejeta Conservancy has announced that veterinarians have extracted ova from the females to be inseminated with northern white rhino sperm collected earlier. The embryos would be inserted into the womb of a surrogate mother from a related rhino species. Olpejeta is working in partnership with the Dvor Kralove Zoo in the Czech Republic, where these rhinos were born in captivity. The 10 collected ova from the creatures were airlifted to the conservancy where they will be fertilized. They hope to produce a pregnancy soon, but getting a calf will take time, says John Stechkal of the Dvor Kralove Zoo.
We have to take into account that gestation period of a rhino is about 16 months. So even if we would succeed in coming, let's say, 1 year, it would not be realistic to expect to have a northern white rhino baby born before, let's say, 3 years.
The cost of the exercise was not disclosed, but the price is expected to be high. Olpejeta CEO Richard Vine says the cost is worth it.
We have it within our power, not only for the rhinos, but for other species as well, to reverse this process, to live better with the planet, to live more in tune with our environment.
Still, there's no guarantee the IVF method will work. A 50% chance, said Stechkal.
We did really good progress, and I think that this progress can give us optimism that we will be successful even in next steps.
It seems there's every reason to take the risk, because when these two northern white rhinos pass away, they will be buried next to Sudan, taking the species with them to the grave, to be lost forever. Ruth Elmendorp for VOA News, Olpejeta, Kenya.
In Rwanda, there is an ongoing debate over the authenticity of poverty statistics. The government says poverty has dropped dramatically, but people who are actually destitute and their advocates are skeptical. Eugene Wimana has more details from Rwanda.
79-year-old Gwandoni Ananias Munyarubuga, who lost his legs in a motorcycle accident, lives in utter poverty. The house he lives in is very bad. He works flagrantly. He says to eat is not easy. He says he can even spend more than 3 days without eating, waiting until someone brings him some food. He says the poverty is huge. Munyarubuga still hopes for government assistance, but cannot get the help he needs. He says the authorities have told him that to get a house, he needs to have a plot of land. But he says he doesn't have land and cannot get it. He says he's asking the government to build him a house so he can at least have shelter for his remaining days on earth. The Rwandan government says extreme poverty in the country dropped dramatically by 2017 to 34% of the population, compared to more than 60% in 2007. But the London-based Financial Times newspaper reports the government has manipulated the poverty statistics allegedly to prop up Rwanda's President Paul Kagame. Kagame has dismissed the report.
And I think it originates from also the stereotypes, the prejudice that is always out there. It's as if Africans can't do fine. Africans have to be doing things that must be validated by others somewhere. But we don't need any validation. We want to do things that benefit us, that put us in a place where we want to be.
World Bank economist Agassi Machian acknowledged that Rwanda has made great strides since the 1994 genocide.
For the last two decades, the average growth rate was about 7%. And it was quite broad-based. So we see traditional sectors in Rwanda, like agriculture and others, you know, growing at quite a strong pace. But also Rwanda has seen emergence of new sectors.
But Matian and others say the country still has a long way to go.
Poverty reduction was relatively small between 2014 and 17. And as you recall, those were difficult years for Rwanda. Rwanda suffered enormous droughts in 2015 and 16. There was also a slowdown in growth in 2015 and 16.
An estimated 40% of Rwandans live on less than $2 a day. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Nigeria's government for years has been seeking a lasting solution to the conflict between farmers and herders over grazing lands, a conflict that has claimed thousands of lives. The country's Middle Belt region is most affected by the dispute, and recently the government introduced a settlement plan for herders aimed at ending the clashes. But the settlements known as Ruga in Hausa are meeting some resistance, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
For Haruna Issa, it's a daily struggle to keep his father's herd well fed. He gets up early to find a few good grazing spots around the city center of Nigeria's capital. When he ventures out, he often has to share the spots with other herders and says he can get in trouble when his cows stray into farmland. Sometimes we have a problem with the farmers when the cows enter their farm and destroy the crops. The farmers seize our tools and sometimes our herds until we pay some ransom to get them back. The conflict between cattle herders and farmers in Nigeria dates back decades. Population growth, urbanization and desertification triggered by increasing climate change have escalated the conflict. More than 3,600 people have been killed in clashes over grazing land between 2015 and 2018. And thousands more have been displaced. The government says establishing cattle settlements or rugas for the herders will address the issue. Garba Abari is Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency.
What it is intended to do is purely to find a way of mitigating the movement of pastoralists.
But the government plan has met with stiff resistance, especially from eastern and southern Nigeria, where residents like Ben Ijeoma say they will not give up their lands for these settlements.
It's not a scheme that can assist the country. Because already we have rugas that are existing. And those rugas have been abandoned. What happened to the foreign, to the initial rugas that we have? These are the questions Nigeria should keep asking.
The pilot phase of the government's cattle settlement plan provides for 6 settlements per state. These settlements will be equipped with schools and hospitals for herders and their families. Nana Bashir of the Farmers Association of Nigeria says the group hopes to see this plan put an end to the crisis or reduce it significantly to enable farmers return to their farms.
We need peace. We the farmers, if there is no peace, we cannot farm. If we don't farm, we cannot produce food for the Nigerians to eat.
For now, Nigerian authorities have suspended the plan temporarily to continue discussions with stakeholders. While that happens, herders like Haruna will have to make do feeding their cattle, even if they create a public nuisance. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the continent has seen a decline in the number of authoritarian regimes since the 80s, but still, the number of democracies has not increased significantly. A report card on democracy on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.